tariffs, trade wars, and Brexit. Is this really the end of globalization, or have we just forgotten our history? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. The growth of world trade has slowed down sharply since 2011, and for some populist politicians today, one in particular, globalisation has become a dirty word. Newspapers declare that globalisation is finished and argue that it was responsible for much of the political turmoil that we see today. But a recent discussion paper by Kevin O'Rourke, the research director of the CEPR, reminds us that we have been here before, and that economic history has a lot to teach us about the problems of globalisation and what we might do to lessen its negative effects. Today I've come to the University of Oxford to meet him and find out more about what his paper calls economic history and contemporary challenges to globalisation. Kevin, welcome to Vox Talks.
Thanks very much.
Your paper reminds us that globalisation's not a process that started in the 1980s. How far back can we trace the roots of what you define as globalisation?
Well, as your question suggests, it all depends on what you define by globalisation. You can find long-distance trade occurring in the Iron Age. You can find it occurring in the Bronze Age because people needed to import copper where they didn't have it. You can find it during the Pax Mongolica when the Mongols unified large bits of Eurasia. But I think that the globalization that emerged in the 19th century was different both in scale and in kind. In scale, because the amounts of goods that were being traded bore no comparison to the scale of trade that we saw earlier. What you saw for the first time really was the development of regular mass trade between continents across oceans, not in high value goods, but in the most basic commodities, in wheat, in iron ore, in this kind of thing. And that meant that long-distance trade during that period started having the sorts of effects that were identified by these two Swedish economists that we may talk about in a moment, Eli Heckscher and Bertil Ohlin. And that's not surprising, because actually when Heckscher and Ohlin were developing their theories in the early 20th century, what they were actually trying to do was understand what they thought they had seen in the run-up to World War I.
Back in the present, many people assume that we're entering a period of deglobalization. Is this really what's happening?
We may or we may not be entering a new period of deglobalization, but I don't think that I'd point to a slowing growth of trade as evidence for that. Either way, if US multinationals decide that they want to onshore production that had previously been taking place in China, and if they do that simply because they want to be closer to the consumer or because relative costs have shifted, I don't see that as evidence of deglobalization. If, on the other hand, they took that decision because they're worried about tariff barriers or if transport costs had all of a sudden gotten much bigger, that would be a different thing. So I tend to think about this in terms of the costs of doing business across borders. So long as the costs are low, you may choose to do a lot of business, you may choose to do not very much business, but that's your decision. It's the fact that costs are low that is the important factor here. And in history, when we see real episodes of genuine deglobalization, what you find is price gaps, identical commodities priced in different markets. You find them exploding. And I don't think we see evidence of that yet, which isn't to say that we shouldn't be very worried by the brewing trade war between the US and China. And I think that actually an even more worrying thing that's happening right now is the way in which Trump is systematically undermining the WTO by refusing to appoint judges there, because if we move below a certain number of judges, the WTO can't function properly, and that would be very dangerous.
You mentioned Heckscher and Ohlin, and they predicted that countries that have abundant land or labour or capital will export goods that make intensive use of those factors. Now, we've seen how this process plays out in the last wave of globalisation, most obviously in increased competition from China for some industries in Europe and the US. How strong is the parallel to the social impact of 19th century globalisation?
The 19th century, in particular the late 19th century, is maybe the closest parallel to what we see today. It was a period of unprecedented globalization. You had railroads and steamships lowering transport costs between continents. the railroads make it possible to get goods to the seaports in the first place. Couldn't have had wheat from Kansas showing up in Liverpool without the railroads. So they're an important part of the story. And what that means is that farmers, tenant farmers, owner-occupiers, landlords are all exposed to competition from very cheap New World food. So that puts food prices under pressure in Europe. It puts land prices under pressure. It puts rents under pressure. And in many countries, in Germany, in France, Sweden and Italy, you see in the late 1870s, early 1880s, the reversal of a trend that had been ongoing for 25 years. So for 25 years, we'd been seeing trade policies getting gradually more liberal. From 1880, roughly onwards, agricultural tariffs start being imposed or are increased. And so we see here a case where globalization sows the seeds of its own destruction by creating winners and losers. So that's the obvious analogy to reach for when thinking about, for example, why people might be voting for Donald Trump, although I think the analysis is a little bit complicated. So if you look at the author Dorn Hansen, factors of production aren't fully mobile between all sectors, as in the Heckscherian model. Indeed, that's the whole point of what they're finding. They're finding that labour is not as mobile as some models would predict it ought to be between the different regions of America, and that therefore, when this China shock that they talk about hit, you get the regions that are more exposed to the China shock, suffering greater wage falls, greater increases in unemployment, and crucially, greater political polarization. Regions that were already Republican are now becoming more conservative. Regions that were Democrat either vote for more left-wing Democrats or for right-wing conservatives. So that's another case of globalization helping to undermine itself, although I wouldn't want to say that Trump or Brexit is just about globalization. It's obviously a lot more complicated than that.
What can the existing research and models that you've looked at in this paper tell us about the impact of globalization on inequality through history?
In the historical literature, people have focused, for example, on the relative wages of unskilled workers and landowners. So that globalization shock I talked about earlier actually reduced inequality in Europe because those unskilled workers had cheaper food and the rich landlords had lower rents. Of course, Heckscherian logic might suggest that you could have had the opposite effects on the other side of the Atlantic. And there is some evidence that the wage to rental ratio moved in the opposite direction in land abundant countries. So yeah, I suppose that one lesson from the 19th century is that globalization has different effects on income distribution in different parts of the world, and that presumably is true today as well.
Yeah, it's also apparent from your paper that today's debates about globalization's impact on immigration, wages and employment are nothing new. And it's equally apparent that these debates are just as difficult to settle conclusively today as they ever were.
That sort of makes sense, really, because you'd expect the effects of immigration on the wages of native workers or on income distribution more generally to depend on the size of the flow, the nature of the flow, who these people are, what their labour market characteristics are they allowed to work at all in the first place, on the skill composition of the local labour force and on the institutions that shape the way in which labour supply and labour demand interact to produce given wage outcomes. And so that's why if you look at the literature that's being produced today on this topic, if you go through the top five journals over the past 5 or 10 years and look for papers on the effects of immigration on wages or unemployment or other labour market outcomes, you'll find some that find no effect whatsoever. And you find others that do find effects. And that doesn't really surprise me.
It's easy for us to slip into talking about globalization as a purely economic process, and that can lead us to think about the popular backlash demonstrated in events like Brexit purely in economic terms. Is this interpretation dangerous? Is it too narrow?
Yeah, it is too narrow. And I observed that when people talk about the causes of Brexit or Trump, they tend to want a simplistic conclusion of one sort or another. So for some people, it's all cultural because these people are hillbillies, they're ignorant, they're conservative. In that case, I suppose you have to explain why they became more conservative all of a sudden. Other people want to argue that it's only globalization, but I don't think either interpretation makes a lot of sense. If you think about the Brexit vote, you have people in deprived areas in the north of England who are voting for Brexit. And I'm very taken with the research of Sasha Becker and Dennis Novy and Tim O'Fetzer up in Warwick. They find very strong evidence that the Brexit vote is linked to measures of austerity. There's a recent paper in the American Political Science Review by Colin Toney and Stanig that find that the Brexit vote is very closely related to the Autor et al. China shock. So that's an economic account of what happened. But we know that the people in the north of England are not the only people who voted for Brexit, and if they had been, Brexit wouldn't have been passed. We know that there are people who are doing perfectly well in the home counties and elsewhere who voted for Brexit because they have principled objections to European supranationalism, or simply because they're nationalists. You know, when you have more than 30 million people voting, you have very different sorts of people voting for very different sorts of reasons. And not only do we not have to choose between cultural and economic explanations for something like Brexit or Trump, I don't think we should choose. I think that it's complicated. And by the way, it gets even more complicated than that, because all of these factors, the economic factors or jingoism or whatever, these are structural factors. But there's also chance accidents that happened that probably made a difference to the outcome. There's lots of scope for individual mistakes and choices to play a role when you have something like this occurring.
One era of deglobalization that we skipped over so far has been what happened during the World Wars and the Great Depression. Should we see the events of the 20th century as a warning to us of what might happen if governments embrace economic nationalism too enthusiastically?
Yes, that's for sure. In the 1930s, trade barriers went up. We all know that. That had an impact on the total volume of trade. Not maybe as big an impact as people sometimes think, but it certainly led to less trade. But what it also certainly did, and this is based on work I've been doing with colleagues in Queen's Belfast and Vienna, is that it skewed trade patterns in very sharply. Britain's move towards not only protectionism, but protectionism that was biased in favour of the empire and discriminated against foreigners, helped increase the share of Britain's trade that was with the empire. And so you have the formation of these imperial trade blocs during this period. And one of the things that that gave rise to then is countries starting to think about trade in strategic terms. They started to worry about whether they'd be able to rely on the market for all of the things that they needed for their economic prosperity, but also potentially for the things that they might need in the event of a world war. And so you get a sort of self-fulfilling cycle beginning to emerge where people seek self-sufficiency because they want to be secure in the event of war. But of course, that process ends up in some cases leading to war in the first place. So the 1930s are a cautionary tale, and they are a period that tell us that multilateral trade and multilateral trade organizations and rules that are generally accepted are crucial, not just for our economic well-being, but for geopolitical stability. And that's where especially Mr. Trump, but also Brexit, are, I think, so worrying.
In the paper, you point out that we're not doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. Nothing's inevitable. So on the plus side, is there evidence from the recent economic crisis that we learned some important lessons from previous episodes of deglobalization?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that we have skipped over are the deep causes of 1930s deglobalization. And the deep causes are, of course, the Great Depression and the monetary turmoil that ensued and the demands for protection that politicians everywhere were faced with. The Great Depression was caused by flawed macroeconomic policy. We know that from the work of Barry Eichengreen and Peter Temin and Milton Friedman and Maynard Keynes. Just about everybody agrees on that who knows anything about the period. It also flowed, I would say, and this is a point that German economic historians have always made, and now maybe post-Eurozone crisis we're beginning to understand this better. It also flowed partly from the malfunctioning of international capital markets, because there is a story about capital flowing into Germany and elsewhere and a sudden stop and capital being withdrawn, and this increasing the pressure on governments to pursue wrong-headed austerity policies and so forth. And so there were lessons that were learned from that period that largely had to do with the need for Keynesian policies when you're at a Keynesian time in the business cycle. And those lessons were applied in 2009. Then, of course, they were disapplied in the Eurozone in 2010. And that then gave rise to, well, all of the problems that we know, and probably also helped to explain the Brexit vote, not because the UK was directly affected by Eurozone turmoil, but because it made it much easier for Brexiteers to point the finger at Europe and to say, you know, this was not a club that we should be afraid to quit.
And are there also lessons from history about sharing the benefits of global trade more fairly in future? Things that, with hindsight, policymakers this time around didn't take enough account of?
In my earlier work with Jeff Williamson on 19th century globalisation, we presented a rather simplistic account of what politics is all about. So countries were exposed to these income distribution effects of globalization, and then they had a simple choice. Do you remain open or do you go closed? And I suppose that a politician might find it more useful to think about, well, what could I do to diffuse these political pressures? How could I have my cake and eat it, remain open and remain in power? And in fact, in the late 19th century, you see the beginnings of social insurance programs, accident compensation programs, unemployment insurance programs, old age pensions, and so forth. And what Michael Huberman and co-authors have shown is that this move towards, you know, the beginnings of what will eventually become in the mid-20th century a full-blown welfare state is most precocious in the countries that are most open to international trade. So globalization wasn't leading to a race to the bottom during that period. If anything, it was associated with an expansion of welfare states. And sometimes what you see, indeed, is something that will then become very familiar to us through the European integration process, which is countries saying, we will do a trade deal with you so long as you implement the same sorts of social insurance programs as we are, because we don't want you to benefit from an unlevel playing field and have an unfair competitive advantage. And of course, that's then going to be a crucial part of the European bargain in the 1950s. So that is the obvious mechanism. And I do find it striking and suggestive that the shocks of 2016 didn't happen in the Eurozone, although there are lots of problems in the Eurozone. You know, they didn't happen in the Eurozone where the recovery from 2008 was so woeful. It happened in the US and the UK where the macro policies were much better, where the recovery was much sharper, but also where arguably the pendulum swung more away from the state and towards the market over the course of the previous 3 or 4 decades, and where consequently welfare states and safety nets were being eroded at precisely the time when, because of globalization and other factors, technological change as well, of course, people really needed these safety nets.
Kevin, thank you.
Yeah, good.
The discussion paper is called Economic History and Contemporary Challenges to Globalization. On our site, it is DP13377, and it's a reminder that if we want to understand the impact that economics has on today's news, it's always good to know your economic history too. And bringing history right up to date, Kevin has also just published a book, and that's called A Short History of Brexit. It's out now in Pelican Books. That really is the first draft of history, isn't it, Kevin?
Possibly the second, if you count the newspapers, but yeah.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. If you're listening on mobile, subscribe to us on your podcast platform, or if you're on the VoxEU website, look out for our new improved player, which also offers you the chance to subscribe. A reminder, check out our archive at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.